This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Stephen Pimper. He has just come out with a fascinating new book called A People's History of the Poverty and of Poverty in America. Stephen Pimper, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Happy to be here.
Tell me a little bit about this People's History series. Obviously, there's Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, mm-hmm. and then there are some offshoots, your People's History of Poverty in America being one. What's the series like, and how'd you get involved in it?
The premise behind the series really does begin with Zinn, which builds on the simple observation that most history up until the late 60s, early 1970s, was told from the perspective of great white men and occasionally women. And the idea was that if we were going to tell history, it was what presidents did and what heads of state did and what armies did and what people with power and influence and money did. And that's what history looked like and what history ought to look like. And Zinn and a number of other historians in that period began making the argument that history is more complicated, history is deeper, history is broader, and that the full range of experience of all peoples, each in their own way, contributes to the shaping of history. It just turns out to be a richer, fuller, and different history than that very simple sort of hierarchical one. And since Zinn's book, there have been a number of other books specifically built with the People's History title. There have been histories of the Vietnam War, of World War II, People's History of Empire. Dave Zirin has just come out very recently with People's History of Sports.
A fun book.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. Built very much along the same premise that we can look at a broader range of experience, and by doing so, we have a very different kind of understanding of where we've been. And I think part of the idea behind that is that gives us perhaps a charts a better path for where we might move forward.
And Stephen Pimper, you teach at Yeshiva University in New York, and you wrote a previous book on poverty called The New Victorians: Poverty, Politics, and Propaganda in Two Gilded Ages. Mm-hmm. How'd you get into the focus on poverty? Why did that grab you as a focus of now two books?
In the oddest of ways, I was actually working as a corporate paralegal for the Citibank Global Asset Management Division many, many years ago. A job to this day that is the one that I loathed more than all others, and that includes cleaning toilets in a shoe factory is my first job out of high school. And one of the lawyers I worked for was a member of a board of directors for an organization called Artists to End Hunger. And they were half arts organization, half education organization. They commissioned original works from living artists and the estates of deceased artists, put them together as a traveling exhibition, and brought them to, in any given year, 15, 20 cities around the world. And each local host city, in concert with their public school system, was obligated to create a series of educational programs around hunger and poverty issues to coincide with the exhibit. Once the exhibit was finished, they brought all the works back to New York, auctioned them off at Sotheby's and Christie's, and that formed the core of their grant-making program. And Sandra, who was executive director at the time, sucked me in as a volunteer. And before too long, I had gleefully abandoned the job at Citibank and took a 75% cut in pay and happily went and worked for Artists to End Hunger and wound up moving from there to New York's Food and Hunger Hotline, where I helped coordinate soup kitchens and food pantries in the five boroughs of New York City and helped run a technical assistance program to help mostly community-based and church-based food programs figure out how to find, produce, and deliver food with absolutely no resources whatsoever. And from there, inexplicably found myself moving into a graduate program where I studied with Francis Fox Piven, and moved a little more into the academic side of organizing and of service delivery.
But this has been more than just an academic interest.
Absolutely.
You were there at the provision level.
Absolutely.
And you saw it up close. And yeah. I think that comes through in this book of People's History of Poverty in America, that it's not just some remote academic ivory tower interest. But one of the things you try to do that I think is fascinating in this book is let people speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And mostly this wasn't primary research on your part, but you did a lot of secondary research and got people's voices
Correct.
In. And how did you go about doing that?
By reading as much as – I mean, I spent an enormous amount of time simply combing through previously published ethnographies, through diaries, through case records, through journals, through other people's histories. I mean, the bulk of what I am culling from is dependent upon extraordinary work that's been done by others. And what I've done is judiciously stolen from them and pieced it together. But tried to gather as much as I possibly could by way of first-person accounts of the experience of being poor, in need, or of interacting with public and private institutions of relief.
And why do you think that was an important way to go as opposed
it to... It actually came out of the first book in which the New Victorians was an argument that looking at 1996 as welfare reform, part of the argument that I make is that 1996, in fact, is not the aberration or the singular event that it was often characterized as, but in fact returns us back to our steady state.
This is Bill Clinton's end of welfare as we
that's
know
right.
it.
Mm-hmm. And I argue that, in fact, the 20th century, the programs of the New Deal and Great Society are aberrations. And that, in fact, if you look at welfare reform in 1996, what we're really doing is returning to both a set of moral arguments of the late 19th century about what the causes of poverty and what the causes of need are, and returning to a very similar set of institutional solutions. Privatization, pushing service delivery back into churches so that there is less by way of legal obligation for provision and much more discretion in terms of how well things are funded.
I mean, some of those same arguments you have sprinkled through this book, too.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting you talk about the running away from institutional solutions. Interesting for me to find in this book, A People's History of Poverty in America, a quote from Thomas Paine about how it's important to have institutional solutions and that it all can't be done individually through charities.
Well, there's a credible argument to be made that it was Thomas Paine, actually, who offered the very first comprehensive program of a welfare state, really a vision of a welfare state, which is something I don't actually discuss in this book. But in Rights of Man, he devotes more than a few pages to articulating something that looks as if it were pushing right up against the edges of a social democratic welfare state.
And the moral arguments today, I mean, this is 1996 plus 12 or 13 years, but they're the same arguments you hear.
Absolutely.
As prevailed there. And this is the thing that Clinton is going to take to his grave and should be on his tombstone, that he devastated
Absolutely.
The social safety net for poor women and children in this country. But that, you know, basically it's blaming the victims.
Absolutely. That the causes of poverty are moral. They're individual. That it's you're stupid, you're lazy, you're not trying hard enough, you're not working hard enough, you're ignorant, you're drug-addled, you're drunk. I mean, it's if you were not immoral and unethical and unconscionable in some way, then clearly there's no possible other explanation for your problem. I mean, some of this is rooted in that very simplistic notion of the American dream.
Of rugged individualism.
That clearly, given the abundance of opportunity, the utter lack of discrimination, the lack of barriers, the sheer opportunities for mobility. I mean, that enduring myth, if that were to be true, well, what other explanation could there be?
So but what are the basic fallacies of that myth then?
Well, it's all false. I mean, start with mobility, right? This is something that we tend to latch onto and pride ourselves in. If you look at income mobility, you would be better off in virtually any other of the 18 nations of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Western industrialized states. If you look at mobility levels, if you're born poor in the United States, you are more likely to die poor than you are in most Western industrialized nations. The notion that somehow there are greater opportunities for income mobility in the United States is simply not borne out by the evidence. Look at recent unemployment numbers. numbers, right? Official numbers at 6.5, pushing 7%. We know how well those numbers understate actual unemployment. Assume that it's somewhere closer to perhaps 13-14%, if you count people who are not looking, given up looking for work, or are employed part-time because they can't find full-time work.
I mean, this
if
is,
one is unemployed under those circumstances, clearly there's something at work there other than moral failure. If you're from where I am in New York,
and the system
and you see,
that,
you know,
too.
All the jobs that are being laid waste to on Wall Street, yeah. Those are not folks who are losing their jobs. I'm talking about secretarial support. I'm talking administrative support. I'm talking about sort of all of the ancillary support services. Those are not folks who have lost their jobs out of some moral failure. They're lost their jobs arguably from somebody else's moral failure, but they're going to be struggling to get by. It's obvious in some ways, and yet there's still this persistent notion that something must be wrong with you if you're unemployed.
And then the way that the apparatus has been set up, the intrusiveness of the bureaucratic system. There's one woman in here who was swearing a lot, but basically saying, just give me my check and don't make me jump through all these hoops. You're just trying to shame me. And there is this prevailing sense that people who get any government assistance have to be shamed to get it.
Absolutely. And arguably, it fulfills a function. Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward call it the ritual degradation of a pariah class. The notion that if you can sufficiently degrade and humiliate those who seek public assistance, you make low-wage work, no matter how unattractive, no matter how degrading itself, that much more desirable. That you, in fact, dissuade people from seeking out that kind of relief. And you have this added value of them being there as an object lesson. So whether it's today in New York, seeing people on the workfare program, literally with orange jackets that mark them out as distinct, I'm hard-pressed to identify how that's different than in the 1600s, requiring public paupers to wear a P emblazoned across their chest.
No, I never knew that happened, but then I was reading your book, Stephen Pimpare, author of A People's History of Poverty in America, and true enough, there you say in 1718 in New York City, if you were getting some public money, you had to wear a P for poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Or you blue or red cloth. This is the scarlet pea.
That's right. Now, this, by the way, this is not an American invention. I mean, this is a practice that goes back to the Middle Ages, but one that I think that we hung on to longer than many other nations did.
There's a line that repeats in a couple places in this book from individuals themselves. I'm not stupid. I'm just poor. And that's from people who believe that they're being told that they're stupid. And that they're inept or incompetent or somehow at fault. And it is really kind of a gnawing, indicting, kind of a crushing statement for people to make. And the person who was taking that demography down, taking those oral histories down, that must have grabbed them because it grabbed me even just reading it. Tell me also a little bit about the idea that we can solve poverty with more generous social welfare programs, because that goes against all the kind of the Republican doctrine that,
absolutely.
There's a culture of poverty or that welfare programs are themselves perverse and that they reinforce the very habits or attitudes, again, being blaming the victims for their moral turpitude. But actually, you make the argument that we can pretty much attack poverty successfully with a well-designed government program.
It is in fact more complicated than simply throwing money at poor people, but it's not actually all that much more complicated than that. I think it's startling that it's counterintuitive to say that if you again look at other Western industrialized nations, all else equal, the more money they devote to programs designed to alleviate poverty and need among its citizens, the lower the indices of poverty and need are among its citizens. And I think it's actually quite striking that I have to feel self-conscious about saying something like that, because we inhabit a political culture in that is so counterintuitive that simply designing programs to reduce poverty could reduce poverty. That can't possibly be right.
And, of course, the right-wing claim is that, you know, old people just want to have more babies and not work.
Yeah, it's. I mean, one of the threads that I try to carry through the book is that on those rare occasions when poor Americans have demanded anything at all, what they've demanded is a decent, safe job at a living wage, not welfare. The problem is what they've had to settle for when they can get anything at all is paltry and demeaning aid of some sort. And one of the arguments that I make is that it's an indication as to how poorly we've misdiagnosed the problem that we focus our attention on welfare as opposed to employment. Are there exceptions? Are there people who do want to sit around collecting food stamps and use it to buy vodka and with Red sitting in their mink coat off to drive their Cadillac in Reagan's famous welfare clean? Absolutely. It's a nation of 300 million people. There there's a case or case of everything. But by and large, the overwhelming majority of all Americans, right, value the same reason that we do, right? Value work. That want that self-respect, the dignity, the self-reliance, the ability to provide for themselves and their families, the worth that comes from that, the satisfaction that comes from that. Maybe that's a basic human kind of desire. It doesn't differ among poor people.
I mean, given the fact that these kinds of programs are established in most other Western industrialized mm-hmm. countries, why don't we have those here? Why has there been such resistance to this kind of basic economically sensible and morally mandatory kind of a program?
I mean, I know that for many people, the answer to that is a resort to political culture, right? There's something about that that's antithetical to the American creed. I've never been particularly satisfied with those kinds of explanations, and unfortunately, my explanation is much less interesting and much drier. I think part of it is rooted in the Constitution itself. I think it's the structure of our political systems.
How so?
We have designed a set of political institutions, and Madison was explicit about this, that are expressly designed to inhibit the ability of even determined majorities to exert their will. It's why when we do create broad-based social programs, they seem to come in these enormous bursts at moments of enormous crisis, because only when the system is strained to the breaking point are we able to overcome its structural resistance to change. We've got a political system that has greater opportunities for special interests and business interests to exert their will. There are so many opportunities for a veto, to put a no somewhere in along the process. And all you need is one no in a very long chain required to get anything accomplished. I think another piece of this is that, again, looking cross-nationally, one of the greatest predictors of the generosity and depth of a welfare state is Labor Party power. Right. Very direct correlation. How strong is the Labor Party? You can see it correlate directly with how broad and how deep the welfare state is. Well, the United States doesn't have much by way of a Labor Party. Again, I don't think that's a political culture kind of explanation. I think that's an explanation that's rooted in the fact that we suppressed the labor movement in the late 19th century with violence in a way that was uncommon among other nations, and that we have erected an elaborate set of laws, particularly post-1940s, that inhibit the ability of people to form unions.
There is some cultural argument, though, that you do make. Stephen Pimper, who is the author, by the way, of A People's History of Poverty in America. And that, as you say, Americans are callous when they are not indifferent. That was a line that just jumped out at me. Defend that and tell me how we become concerned and caring.
Defend the callousness of the United States.
No, defend the assertion that they're callous.
Well, it's. I mean, what I meant by that is. I mean, I was referring to our politics more than I was to the population at large. I think on an individual level, maybe this is one of the few places left where I still sort of have some mushy naivete left in me. I do think that most people, when confronted with suffering of another human being, are troubled by that, and I think most people actually work to alleviate that or one, in one way or another. I think the problem comes when you look at national policy, when you look at state-level policy, when you look at our politics, that has so internalized the notion that it is enabling, that it is disabling, that it is dangerous to offer that kind of assistance, that it is somehow unmanly to require need or to offer need.
Some of it also may be that you're observing that there are many Americans who can go along their merry way and not see or observe the fact that there are poor people in this country.
Although fewer than one might think. I mean, I think the first thing that's useful to point out there is that if you look not just at poverty at any given moment in time, which is usually how we measure it, right? How many people were poor in 2007? But instead, look at how many people are poor at any point over the course of their lives. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of all Americans will be poor at least once in their life. And that's by official standards, which horribly understate poverty. By the same token, 65% of all Americans over the course of their lives will receive some form of means-tested benefits, right? Medicare, food stamps, cash relief, et cetera, et cetera. More people than you might think not only know poor people, but are in fact poor at any given moment themselves.
The stats on food insecurity in this book are astonishing.
Absolutely.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, a third of all children will receive food stamps over the course of their life. The thing that makes that peculiar is this comes up over and over and over again when you look at ethnographies of poor women and when you hang out and talk with poor women, is that they, some of the nastiest things that I have ever heard said about welfare recipients have come out of the mouths of welfare recipients. And it's this fascinating sort of dynamic in which it's always the woman down the hall who's nasty and who's lazy and who doesn't want to work and who doesn't do anything and this is what gives welfare a bad name. Now, she'll always accept herself. And this goes up again and again and again that somehow, and maybe I am making a cultural argument, this sort of notion in the air, the extent to which we've demonized welfare pervades so deeply that even people whose own personal experience speaks against that aren't necessarily able to latch onto the real experience as opposed to that kind of cultural myth.
And they have to take great pains to differentiate themselves from the
Absolutely.
Myth
itself. Well, you also find over and over again that women on welfare will deny being on welfare. I mean, I presumably part of that is a defense mechanism, right? Because if all of these folks on welfare are supposed to be so horrible and nasty, well, I'm not horrible and nasty, therefore I can't be on welfare. So you know. They'll talk about, well, you know, I get a check once a month, but that's not welfare. That's something different.
You also, one of the commonalities over time that you talk about in this book of People's History of Poverty in America is the attitude, the kind of noblesse oblige attitude. You have rich ladies in New York bringing potted plants to the poor, and that wasn't well received. Tell that little story.
Do we have a couple of minutes? Should I read those two paragraphs?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm speaking with Stephen Pimper, who is the author of a fascinating new book called The People's History of Poverty in America. This is part of the People's History series that Howard Zinn is the series editor of, and this is a new press, a series that is really delightful.
One December, early in the terrible depression of 1893, with Christmas approaching, a parade of finely attired ladies from the Children's Potted Plant Society made their way down to the slums of New York's Lower East Side on a charitable mission. Their plan was simple. They would give a small plant to each of the neediest young cases, offering them a bit of life and color for their grim, cramped abodes. They looked forward to the grateful, smiling faces as they distributed their bounty, one little plant to each little pauper. Perhaps that warm thought made up for the trepidation they must have felt venturing into such foreign territory. Helen Gould, daughter of Jay Gould, the ruthless robber baron, counted the society among her most favorite charities. Perhaps you can imagine their surprise, then, when instead of being met by an orderly procession of humble supplicants, the children rushed the staging area, seized four or five plants apiece, and ran off to market them on the streets. The women were beside themselves with fear and perplexed. For some, it probably confirmed their belief that the poor were irredeemable. They were only trying to help, after all, and were met with incivility and ingratitude. And the point that I go on to make is that, of course, it's the children who are probably more likely to be surprised, because what on earth are these crazy old women from the Upper East Side in all of their fancy clothing doing coming down to give them plants when the list of desperate needs is so extraordinarily long?
And part of it is just a total lack of empathy that people
more than just empathy, understanding, knowledge,
cannot put themselves in the shoes of someone else who doesn't have the luxuries that they have. And then when the kids act in a way that's totally rational, if you were in their shoes, can't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, in some way, I'm being unfair, perhaps, to those kind of philanthropists and social workers and charity workers, because they really do mean well. But that's not enough. I mean, to mean well without taking the trouble to genuinely understand what help looks like from the vantage point of that other person is not offering assistance that's really designed to help. It's offering assistance that's designed to make you feel better for offering it, which is unfortunately what a lot of charity winds up being.
Well, this is a crucial point. When charity isn't enough, and what kind of charity or what kind of program do we need to eradicate poverty in this country? We're here in the giving season now, late in the year. What advice do you have for people who want to deal with this subject? And it's criminal that it only comes up, or mostly comes up, at the end of each year.
Well, when I was at Food and Hunger Hotline and working at soup kitchens and food pantries, I mean, I must confess, there's nothing I loathed more than getting around to Thanksgiving time, because the phones would suddenly be ringing off the hook with people who wanted to come in and help, and they all meant well, and they all wanted to help, and they were available for the following hours on the following days, and they wanted to do this kind of work, and they didn't want to do that kind of work. But throughout the rest of the year, when we were desperate for people to offer help, there was nobody to be found. And it has left a very bad taste in my mouth about that sort of spot volunteering. I mean, for folks who really do want to offer assistance, don't show up at Thanksgiving and Christmas. There are way more bodies than anybody needs. Make a commitment. Find a local organization of any kind, of anything that's doing work that is of interest to you. Don't walk in having decided what it is that you can do. Get to know them a bit and find out what they need and whether you can be of any use to them. And it may turn out that that organization is not somebody that you can necessarily be helpful with. And that sort of genuine effort to offer assistance that's more than just making you feel good for offering assistance. And that's a good thing, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's insufficient. The other thing is to not focus just on that micro level, but to think about what you can do politically. I think in the wake of this year's election, I think one of the challenges that the nation faces is whether the newfound activism among large numbers of people who have traditionally not been active in the political system is over now that voting is over, or whether that mobilization is something that can be contained and continued.
Well, let's hope that mobilization continues, because we're going to need that kind of mobilization to get at some of the crying social needs that we've been talking about this last half hour. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Stephen Pimpare has been my guest. He's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America. Stephen Pimpare, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.